Hi, I'm Barry Osborne, producer of The Return of the King. Welcome to the third and last of the production commentaries. It's been a pleasure to be with you over the last 3 years, and we welcome you once again.
I remember when we first put that on film three.
Yeah, put the old New Line logo on.
Yes.
Yeah.
All of a sudden it was really happening.
I remember when we first shot the title sequence 5 years ago.
I know, I'm still using it.
The title, that was our last shot in the Fellowship that we finished. We did that here, yeah.
So the interesting about this start is originally this was intended to be in film two, but it ended up not fitting in well enough with the overall movie, and Peter decided to pull it out and keep it for film three.
A really unconventional way to start the third film, but cool.
Cool because it's green, and you think you're thinking of Fellowship, but what you're really thinking is before Fellowship.
I remember Peter was going to reshoot this because the water was dirty and muddy. That it had rained for days when we went out to shoot the scene. And we had the idea of going to visit Peter Doyle, our friend, the digital color grader. And he pulled this out and made this water look so great and so idyllic. And here we are, didn't have to reshoot it.
This shot is actually the first shot that we finished for the Two Towers, which got moved into Return of the King. So that was set up as an elaborate miniature.
They shot a green screen shot of him on wires with a lot of wind and stuff blowing on him. And then we shot an environment representing the bottom of this lake.
At that moment, when he comes out of the water, you hear the ring theme. Peter felt that the sound captured more the evil of the moment.
One of the things way back at the start was the ring and the nature of the ring. What that Peter wanted out of the ring was to make it into a character. And it was great because we've been able to hint at the nature of the ring in the previous two films, but wasn't until this scene that we could really start to tell the story of the ring and what the ring is. The ring speaks differently to different people depending upon the nature and the character of the person. So it was being very sweet and enticing to Deagle. But then when the ring noticed Smeagol and noticed a character that could be corrupted, it immediately started working on Smeagol on a slightly different level.
Right around this moment, we take the music away, and that starts to shift the scene from this sweet, bucolic scene to this sort of to a scene where the ring just becomes the center. So we have the throb, heartbeat of the ring, and it's driving the whole scene. We went through a couple of variations in the mix where the sound effects that weren't associated with the ring start to pull back all the foley and the struggling sounds to sort of make you feel a little more removed and like the ring was really having more power. But what we found that did to the scene is it actually gave it less visceral impact. So we dialed that back a little bit and made all the struggling effects more realistic and I think it makes it more violent.
Mm. And in fact, the problem we had in the mix was trying to find a balance between making the scene work how we wanted it and not being too violent. And various mixes we had of it just was too much. It was too full on. You were too involved, and it got nasty.
We extended this a little bit. This was shortened for the MPA to get the PG-13. The original plan, though, was, of course, to start film three with the forging of the sword.
That's right.
Which was actually a pretty dynamic opening. So from what I can recall, anyone I've spoken to got quite a surprise when this scene was used as an opener for film three. It was pretty unexpected.
Yeah.
But I think this was a far better option. There was a lot of call out there to know a bit more about the background of Gollum. So it was the ideal opportunity to have it because you couldn't have put it anywhere else in film three once you got into the process of getting film three underway. This shot too, we shortened this at one stage. You never put the ring on. We didn't want him to disappear. And then later down the track as we're developing the film, we sort of felt that the viewer needed to remember that because it hadn't happened since film one of him, of anyone disappearing, putting the ring on.
Yeah.
So we decided to put the disappearance on because it made sense for later down in Mount Doom when try to put the ring on disappeared. So it just took people back to that moment.
So this whole sequence was directed by Fran Walsh, as I recall, with Andrew Lesney. And it was done on a stage, and it was just a great montage of Smeagol turning into Gollum.
And one of the great things for us, I think, is that Andy actually gets screen time here, and he put so much effort into creating Gollum that it's great to see him on screen. Of course, this was some kind of gelatinous fish that we made. That's pretty disgusting,
no,
but very effective.
No real fish were harmed in the making of these films.
Andy's casting as Smeagol is also one of the huge factors in our last-minute redesign of the digital Gollum.
Come film two, while doing pre-production, you had to make the choice. This is the design what we have right now.
It was more like we need to redesign Gollum so that he can do this. We definitely need to redesign him because of this scene.
Right.
Because people are going to see Andy Serkis as Smeagol, and they're going to go, what the hell is this creature that looks nothing like him whatsoever?
Yeah.
Based on the old design, Pete was looking at Andy's performance on screen and going, I really like what he does with his mouth there.
I know.
I really like what he does with his eyes there.
Puppet couldn't do that.
So didn't look anything like
him. In the end, that's the reason why we did the redesign. Everything else is like a wonderful byproduct of that.
At one stage, we went straight to from the putting the ring on it to the waking up in a nightmare state on the pool by the pool, and then he went over and looked at his own reflection and had that whole Smeagol Gollum type conversation. But this was a fabulous way of doing it. This got straight into the ring. It goes straight into Frodo, and you knew exactly where they were heading.
We would get these shots sequence by sequence. So this sequence of Gollum in the culvert was the first Gollum sequence that we got for Return of the King. So we started work on this one first, which was good because it was a continuation from the last film. And since Gollum goes through such an evolution during Return of the King, as the journey progresses, he gets dirty and more beat up. In this sequence, he had to look just like he did at the end of the Two Towers. So it was a good place to start. Frodo wakes up and talks about how dark it is in Mordor, but it was shot in bright daylight, so we had to replace the background in all of these shots. So everything that you're seeing out the back there, we completely reconstructed.
And we shot this around Ruapehu. It was an area that was struck by lightning, and the trees were devastated and burned, and it was really fortuitous to find this location because it was perfect for the sequence.
Middle Earth Lembas bread.
We had a baker that made our Lembas bread for us in Wellington, and I actually don't remember exactly.
Is it like shortbread or?
It was denser than shortbread. It's actually some sort of. It was probably one of those really good bakers in Wellington.
But it wasn't like disgusting tasting or anything, was it?
No. In fact, I have a whole closet full of Lembas bread. If you want some.
There's a few close-ups, when they shoot back in toward the walls like this. They did rebuild a portion of this for pickups. And what's really amazing is you've got footage here that is, sometimes a span of, two or three years apart.
Yeah, 3 years. Yeah.
Intercuts.
A lot of the stuff where we see Gollum walking, we did a lot of ground interaction elements that were used over and over again, because that's really how the feeling that he has weight is created, is by the way that his feet interact with the ground. And that's just something very subtle, like a pebble getting kicked or slightly sinking into the ground or a little bit of dust or whatever. So we shot a huge number of elements of that kind as a kind of library of ground interaction. Passes on all kinds of leaves and gravel, sand, and so forth. Now this is a scene involving a miniature tree background and a full-size tree foreground, a technique that we developed quite extensively. So that instead of having to build an enormous forest set, basically the forest set could be about one-third of the total depth that you see here, and then everything else behind it is a motion control miniature at 1/6 scale.
Yeah, so this is a miniature where we actually shot some guys on horses, comped them in. And then we had to go, as we rose above the miniature, we went into our digital environment. So it's a combination of digital miniatures.
Hobbits on the Wall.
Hobbits on the Wall were digital. The Orthanc in the wall is a miniature. The trees down below was a separate miniature. And then the surrounding back hills were all digital. So it was this real sort of cut and paste of all these different elements. And then the horses were shot. The guy, Gandalf on the horse, was shot separately. And so we had to track those guys in. And it was a big composite piece that we had to put together.
That's one shot with all the tricks in the book.
One shot, yeah. Yeah, matte paintings, everything in that one. All moving, and all moving differently, unfortunately.
This sequence also was struggling to find a home. It was originally going to be at the end of the second film.
That's right.
Well, these are film two, yeah. We actually started and finished a lot of these for the Two Towers. That's right. Yeah.
And this is more of Weta's invisible work, you know,
yeah,
with all the guys just sitting against the sky, which was just on a stage.
I love this scene also. We have so much fun with it.
On most movies, by the time you're taking your very final pass on the sound, you would in fact have final pictures so you could make sure that everything was in sync. But on this film, the actual delivery date for the final visual effects was about nearly 2 weeks after the final delivery of the sound. And this scene is an example of a place where we were frantically trying to make sure that we had the latest visual effects when we were actually at the print mastering stage in the mix, which is the absolute final pass that you have to get the sound right. So we were adjusting our mix at the very last minute, trying to get everything in sync, and at the end we still were just praying and keeping our fingers crossed that when we were sitting at the premiere everything was going to be in sync.
So this whole sequence for the extended DVD, we got about 60 additional shots of blue screens, and we're having to just sort of match all these to previous shots that we did 2 years ago. And when you look at them, you can't even tell that they're against the blue screen. It looks like they're right in the set. The compositing software that we use Shake on this. You know, you can go to the Apple store now and buy
it. It's not only faster, you know, than it was, you know, digitally a few years ago, but it's hugely faster than in the old photochemical days.
Oh, God, yeah.
When Ray Harryhausen was doing, you know, Sinbad and Gulliver, and it took him 6 weeks to get a traveling mat shot back from the lab.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's virtually instantaneous, and it's much more convincing, too.
This whole section was the end of the Two Towers, you know, the destruction of Isengard, and then, of course, was moved here in a version of the theatrical cut, and then ultimately moved here into the DVD extended cut of Return of the King.
Don't!
Here's one of our very last miniature shots. 35th scale Orthanc spiraling around, revealing Saruman standing on the top.
Along with the crowns of the seven kings. It's an interesting challenge with the eye lines and the voice projection, because they're actually quite far apart.
Saruman's way up the top of the tower and everybody else is down below craning their necks up.
You can't be looking at people's nostrils all the time.
Yes.
You know, to get that sort of thing. So Peter chose to, when he did this, shot this, he chose to keep the eye line down a wee bit. And I remember when we were looking at the data, we kept on saying, gosh, the eye line's totally wrong. It meant to be looking up like a 400-foot tower. But once you actually, when you look at it now, once you look at, put it together, you sort of get used to it. You don't take too much notice of it. But it was, we always thought the island was never quite high enough, but as you said, and we couldn't, anyway, you can't have them looking up too high, because it would made the actors look pretty ugly.
Yeah.
You know, Saruman is talking to these people that are a good 500 feet below, yet he's not really having to scream out. And that's all tied into the fact that he's a wizard and he's able to magically kind of project his voice down below.
It's also whether you shoot it with a long lens or a wide lens, you can make them look a lot closer together.
Also, if they can hear the music, they could probably hear his voice as well from down there.
Exactly. These shots of Saruman, they were done in the parking lot at Stone Street, and we didn't have any need for a blue screen because it was a beautiful blue sky day. It's intercut with this footage of our fellowship in the wet set.
And then everything sort of beyond the horsemen, the terrain, the Orthanc Tower, obviously the ants, those are all digitally and miniature replaced. When we had the pickups, we had Sir Ian and John Reese, and a lot of these were just shot against blue screen, knowing that we were going to need to put these in later.
Christopher Lee
your mercy.
This was probably one of the most heartbreakingly difficult decisions in the theatrical cut editorial process on Return of the King, to move Christopher Lee and Brad Dourif out of it and into this DVD extended cut.
And to his credit, he ended up coming to the premiere in Copenhagen despite all of the original
drama
and pain, because it's a painful decision.
I mean, ultimately, the rationale behind it was that, you know, this is your film to villain, and the destruction and flooding of Isengard was obviously essentially his destruction, so therefore to commence your third film with your film to villain, at least in the theatrical cut, was a difficult pacing issue.
God, there's been so many shift arounds, especially at the front of a film, that it's hard to remember all the permutations we went through, because, you know, how many times did we cut the front of this film?
We cut it quite a few times in the UK, I know.
One of the things that I found really exciting about working with Fran and Peter is that there would be a whole lot of different ways of the structuring of the scenes, and also the internal structure within a scene. There'd be a day, you'd walk into the cutting room, you'd think it would be a normal day, then there'd be this flurry of activity, and Fran would come in, and Pete would say, right, we're going to...
try moving this scene to here and that scene to here.
Yes, and we'll take this one from up there and put it down there and somewhere there. And they'd obviously been talking all night about the Women film. And they come up with quite radical restructuring and shifting about. And it was always pretty blimmin' exciting.
Yeah, it was.
This is a cool shot.
Mm-hmm. I wish you could say that was a miniature trip down the tower, but it's a digital trip down the tower. The reason being that we couldn't get the motion control high enough to actually do the shot.
These other shots that we have were actually Saruman is falling. That ended up being a shot that we did on the stage. Remember that, Brian, where we had him on his elaborate wires
Right.
End over end, which is quite a complicated thing to set up for the stunty, just because of, you know, avoiding the wires, but flipping over end over end.
The interesting thing with that whole scene was it was shot on that back lot, and Hutton, someone sneaked a photo out to some...
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, it was in the paper.
Wellington newspaper. And everyone was like, Gandalf's dead? Saruman.
Yeah,
it must be Saruman.
Gandalf
but where does Saruman die? No, in the book, he dies here. Whoa,
They couldn't actually pinpoint who it was, so that controversy sort of died out. However, I do remember sitting down with Peter and trying to figure out what would happen to Saruman when he fell off the tower, because part of the destruction of Middle-earth is about industrialization and mechanization, and that wheel was something that was being destroyed, was destroyed by the ants, and it was in the water, and we said, well, why don't we have him land on that?
And this is the point that really the whole scene is here for.
Yep,
is
to
now.
Get Pippin to pick up that pound here. That's really the only reason it was... We had to use this part of it in the feature. This was an interesting shot here. It used to be two or three riders riding away from Edoras here, and we had to erase them at Westford and put those digital riders in to head towards Edoras.
One of the most stunning shots in all of Film 3. Mm. And it's there is no mats, no nothing in here. That's as it was.
That shot was backwards, incidentally. That's an amusing sidelight, is that the shot pushing in on Eowyn is actually shot as a pullout.
So everything is going backwards in that shot. And you look at her cloaks, they're sort of in reverse, and smoke is going down chimneys. And we sort of had to pick how many things we wanted to fix before it looked too in reverse.
The smoke, I think, is still going down the chimney.
It is going down the chimney, yeah. And the flags are blowing backwards. We actually had guys walking backwards in the shot, too, and Peter wanted to leave them, and Fran sort of busted him on it. So we were all set to sort of leave that as a tidbit to look for in the DVD.
The great thing about this scene, it's unfortunate it didn't make the theatrical, but there's a lot of good humor in it, and it's also got a couple cameos. So here comes Howard Shore, a nice close-up, our composer right there, as well as Michael Semanek just to his left, who is our dialogue mixer.
They were very disappointed to be cut out of the original theatrical cut.
They'll be very happy to see this scene go back in.
Yeah.
At least I know Michael will.
Yeah, he's the fairly slim, red-haired guy. He kind of expected that he'd be way, way in the back of shot, as did the wardrobe and makeup. And then when he walks on set, Peter grabs her man Howard and plants him directly behind the main character.
This has to be one of the most complicated, intensive ADR films in history. And, of course, it was your job to sort of supervise that whole process. And, hey, lucky you. Glad it wasn't me.
ADR is the process of replacing any dialogue which is deemed to be no good because of extraneous noise. In our case, we had aircraft and background birds. Now, to give you some sort of idea, on most other productions, if you come up with a total ADR cue count of 500 cues, the producer will howl at you because that's way too many. And just for The Return of the King, we've got a smidge over 4,200 cues scripted in our database just for the one film. So there was a bit to actually deal with.
John Rhys-Davies was lovely to have in the editing room. I mean, as footage in the editing room, because he never performed the same take twice. So. Yeah.
He always used all the ad-lib lines too. Yep. Or that hairy woman one in the drinking game was one of his ad-lib lines.
Oh, that goes swimming with little hairy women.
This is a nice little detail coming up here when Gimli falls backwards. All the sounds sort of go away and you get this little chair squeak right as it goes over. That's just such a beautiful little detail that Brent Burge, one of our master effects editors, created.
He can't hold his little.
Game over.
I think it was at this moment when I realized that someday Orlando Bloom will be James Bond.
And, of course, this is a visual effect bringing Merry and Pippin into scale. So it was shot in multiple pass motion control.
This was actually a fun shot to work on and shot the background plate with the party and the table and stuff. And then we did the motion control move much larger on a set with a few plates and whatnot. And Fran directed it and had both actors just sort of make up their own little dance and everything, and it was actually kind of fun afternoon.
Yeah, in fact, she and Philippa Boyens also wrote the lyrics for that song.
Yeah.
Here's an example of a very low, almost, in fact, whispered conversation. Part of Viggo Mortensen's approach to the character of Aragorn was that he was a very calm and control, been around for a while type of guy, and so he never really feels the need to raise his voice too much. So he always, you know, he always talks very low and quietly, and which, you know, I'm sure works well for his character, but it was a complete pain in the ass for us to mix.
This is a tough Gollum shot that Stephen Hornby animated. One thing that helps it subliminally is the scleral displacement on the eye, so you can actually see the eyes moving around, darting around in sort of REM. Underneath the lids, the tissue-thin lids, which gives it a greater deal of reality.
You really feel like you can touch them.
Yeah. There's nothing about them. I mean, that's an example of the amazing animation.
It's such a bold move. It was such a challenge for the CG that Peter threw down for the CG artist to actually create that shot. It's great. It's one of the marks of Peter that he would actually move the camera in so close to a character that's not there, that's CG. Another interesting thing I find is that Peter really pushed to put lights in the eyes. And again, it's a CG character, but he always feels that one of the things that distinguishes a living being is the fact that the eyes are so reflective and so luminous, and it gives you a sort of a feeling of life. And so the highlights in the eyes are all added as almost an afterthought that he pushed for.
This sequence, which rather echoes the soliloquy or the dialogue between Gollum and Smeagol in the previous film, was written and filmed before the schizoid soliloquy, as it came to be known, in the other film. So this was always part of the script, and this was always part of the shooting plan. And the other scene was something of an afterthought. This was done in much the same way, with very close adherence to Andy Serkis's performance in the back and forth, you know. I think one thing on the animation side was that they got to know the character better.
Exactly. Yeah, they got technically better, but as in two, I know the hardest part was just finding what Gollum was. We basically were done tweaking Gollum on the last shot when we delivered the last shot of the film. I mean, we worked on him, you know, on every single shot that we did. So, and we were making him better, and we're getting his skin better, and we're getting the animation tools better. So he never really was Gollum locked off.
People have asked me, once they find out that I was involved with the dialogue in these films, one of the first questions they ask me is, what did you do to Gollum's voice to make it sound that way? And I say, it evolved over time. Andy Serkis basically got the performance and the voice early on, and after that we just worked on enunciation and clarity. And that voice is all him. And in fact, I think in all of his dialogue in two films, we only added some sound effects once, and that was in his very first scene when he attacks Frodo and Sam in the first film. We added a couple of really small growls at one point, but apart from that, it was all him.
Originally, when Gollum wakes up, he's woken up from a dream of his own origin story, having strangled Deagle, but then the feeling was that it would play more directly to the tension of the scene if he was dreaming about, you know, how he's going to deal with his situation and these two hobbits. Ultimately, it worked in better proximity, you know, to start the movie off, to sort of orient it. You get to have some green. We had mentioned it before, to have some green at the start of the movie and sort of have this origin story for Smeagol, Gollum, then sort of interrupt this dramatic tension here, which is, you know, pumping along really nicely to stop, you know, insert a flashback into the sort of the front of it.
This came up for one of those discussions Peter and Fran used to have at night, and they'd come in and say, I've got a really good idea how to do this, and they'd come out and we're going to add these little sequence on the front. We had to change the animation a wee bit, but this is wonderful. This works, this little sequence of Gollum and to it. This scene obviously wasn't put into the theatrical for reasons that it was not essential to the story at the stage.
One of those casualties of length. And it's a beautiful scene.
Yeah, it is. It's lovely seeing this.
Yeah, really gorgeous. It shows, you know, all that beautiful artwork in Edoras. And it's one of the things that just blew me away working with the footage, was working with such wonderful detail in all the backgrounds and, you know, all the sets.
Mm. It's a lovely, lovely wide shots. I mean, this is one of the most spectacular sets in film to me, I think, was the Edoras sequence, these Edoras scenes.
Mm.
I think it's a general impression for a lot of people that it's Edoras is one of the great sets, exterior and interior.
Mm.
There's quite a few different performances to pick on in this scene too. There's some performances of Eowyn's were very tearful, and some were a little less odd. We went for a sort of an intermediary sort of performance, just get a little bit of that watery eyes.
Yes.
Because sometimes you tend a lot of her scenes, you did a little bit too much tear action.
Yeah. Must be terribly hard. It would have been terribly hard for them. I mean, they were shooting three films at once. I mean, to actually get a handle on the development of their character and whether this particular scene was going to be tearful or that one was. God.
I remember Eowyn saying at one stage, if she had known now that all the scenes she shot were going to end up the way they were, she would have done the performance slightly different, not been quite so tearful at certain scenes, you know, building up her performance a bit differently. Mm.
This shot was done during the daytime, and Weta put this great sort of star field out there in the distance above the horizon line, and you know, the whole shot was darkened down to give it this feeling like it's at night. Then this profile shot that turns into a two-shot with Legolas and Aragorn, and that's actually just done over blue screen. And again, Weta just drops in the background, so it's just a nice combination of using the actual location.
And one of those two shots with Legolas and Aragorn, they were actually shot at two completely different times.
There's a lot of stuff like that in this movie where people are conversing in the same shot, and they were shot weeks apart just because of the nature of the shooting, where they had to share the actors among so many different units that it was very hard to actually get the entire group together at one time.
Come in. And this is the reason for the cerimony scene.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. I remember debating when we were wrestling with the length of the theatrical cut, the whole Palantir storyline was one of the things we debated whether we could afford to drop, and of course you can't because it really is what drives the story forward, and we absolutely needed it. But it was one of the things we did look into because of the length.
What we did then was when you lost the death of Saruman, that little bit where the Palantir is in the water, there was a lot of pickup shooting to put the Palantir in the water so that Pippin could find it, and then it could be here at Edoras, since it, you know, since obviously it hadn't, you know, fallen off the rooftop with Saruman.
The interaction with the Palantir and the way he performs it is just so good. It must be great because we sort of know the story, but for the audience who sort of is, this is the first time the Palantir's done that. It must be a total shock when you see it cold.
One thing that we tried very early on with the Palantir was introducing the voice of Alan Howard as Sauron coming through the Palantir, and it's I think it gives it that kind of organic and you know spirit quality that it needs, and also sort of really makes clear that it is a device used for communication.
It basically works both ways. I mean, Sauron can see into the person holding the Palantir, and the person holding the Palantir, if they're strong enough, can see into a Sauron. So it's more than just a video phone. It actually connects people mentally.
And also the other thing with that scene with the Palantir is Billy, when he performed the scene, was jerking himself around so violently. It was interesting to be able to give the Palantir that kind of power and force that could actually throw Pippin that violently, and ended up putting in sounds that were recorded from different pieces of metal that were actually re-recorded and then played out of a speaker, which we were whipping in circles at the end of a rope. And as every time it passed the mic, of course, you get this Dopplered sound of metal or different actually types of grinding sort of violent metal sounds, which gives it this sort of unique energy, and that's the force that's driving the Palantir in these weird, jerky motions.
I saw them.
I always love the artful use of scale, you know, tall Paul's hands on Billy Boyd so that Ian McKellen seems bigger. But at this point in the trilogy, it's taken as a throwaway given, but those are the hands of tall Paul. And tall Paul, who's one of our scale doubles, is actually nearly 7.5 feet tall. I think he was about 7'3", and he also did other jobs in the movie, including he was a driver, and I was driven by him once, and, you know, he had to basically put the front seat into the back seat.
But an honest fool, he remains.
Now, this sequence was tinkered with endlessly, mostly through sound, additional dialogue recording and off-camera lines, because we had to get all kinds of kind of critical plot information, and where are we going from here, what's the plan, what's the mission.
His defeat at Helm's Deep showed our enemy one thing. He knows the heir of Elendil has come.
Like there.
Men are not as weak as he supposed.
You know, with so much dialogue to sell in a very natural way, and I feel like you're...
Yeah.
Hey, look, folks, here's the
information.
Here's the information.
Yeah.
And Ian is just such a wonderful actor. It just comes across very naturally.
He will raise Minas Tirith to the ground.
When it comes to laying dialogue and ADR, we actually break it down to sort of quarter frames. An experienced ADR editor can nudge a line a quarter or half a frame and know that it's made a difference. How can a 48th of a second possibly matter at all? Half a frame can either make or break a line of ADR.
We owe Gondor.
A lot of that almost gets down to an instinctual level. So at a certain level, you know, as an editor, when you've been working with sounds enough, you start to internalize these calls. And so it becomes instinctive.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, your eye may not be able to actually pick up the difference a half frame makes, but your perception of the line and how it's read is better. It sort of plays better. It may be a bit quick for your eye to actually physically pick up, but your conscious impression of the line is that it looks real.
This is pretty well shot exactly as per the script and storyboards, actually, the scene from memory.
This is actually the first time that Pip and Mary are separated through the entire trilogy.
I can't help it.
They've been together the whole time.
No, but it does bring out a point that, you know, when we were doing the shoot, you know, we did get to that moment where, you know, just like with the major parts of the Fellowship, in other words, Sam and Frodo being away from everyone else, when they broke away, you know, they started shooting in other parts of the country and they no longer were hanging with everybody. And that started to then happen with Billy and Dom. And it actually really, you know, added, I think, to the performances because they were no longer together hanging every day, having fun off camera. They were all of a sudden shooting the stuff alone. And, you know, something they could draw from. Last of the Longbottom.
And Inside the Stables is, again, a scene that was shot. It was a cover set originally shot in Methven. They were shot at Erebus. But we also did pickups several times on this sequence. Because when you start to cut the picture and you omit things, you need to explain the transitions that are no longer in the movie.
There's certain emotional things between, say, with Mary and Pippin, and that parting at Edoras. I mean, you don't want to feel that different ways. You want to feel it one way, you know. It wasn't like you wrote the music and then analyzed it over and over and over, you know, and tried to figure out, is that the right, you know. It was just your expression of that. And if it was a true expression, which all of the music is in this movie, there's nothing false about it. You know, it just, it empowered you to create something based on your own true feelings about it.
This little bit is added for the extended cut, this little bit of Mary dialogue. Again, only for pace issue, because it's actually quite beautiful, but in the theatrical version, you really wanted to kind of keep the momentum kind of pulsing along.
Fran shot a lot of the stuff in the forest here, which happened to be another film too scene.
And was moved here into the Return of the King extended cut, the flashback to Arwen's unborn child.
This is a bit of forest that's gotten lots of usage in the various films,
including the end of the second film where Gollum, Frodo, and Sam go off in the same forest, but slightly different area of the forest.
There's an interesting transition here because she's going to see her son race across, and then it pans over to a miniature background.
It's a big moving crane shot. The boy runs up to the step, and he stood still for about 2 minutes, and then he runs off. And so Peter didn't like the stop. So we had to basically remove him or stop him from stopping at that step, which with a camera move was virtually impossible.
Because in a sense you're seeing three different sets all being spliced together. The forest set, the hallway set, and then the set on the outside. This took a lot of doing to match up and make everything hook up, because they're shot at different times and different stages.
Luckily, it got cut out of the second film, and so we had another year to sort of scratch our heads about it, and it still was extremely difficult to do.
This is a triumph of the digital art, the way they managed to actually put it together.
You had to sort of cut him out and retime him and hold him, and it was a nightmare shot to do. And that was one of those shots that just sort of went by and, you know, took us weeks to do that thing. But it all works.
We cannot delay.
This elf, who sort of says to Arwen, you know, m'lady, we must move on, we can't linger, is Figwit, who is, you know, a sort of legendary internet phenomenon.
That's right.
Oh, man.
Figwit has gotten a lot of airtime.
We'd almost need a separate disc to go into all the stories about Figwit, to tell you the truth.
It's been amazing, but Figwit stands for...
Stand for anything?
Yeah. Frodo is great. Who is that? That's Figwit. And there ended up being these people talking on the web wanting to know who this guy was. And
he was this dark, brooding elf in the background.
He was in the council chamber scene.
Yeah.
Yes. And that's where people were talking about it, especially when everybody rallies around Frodo. There he is in the background.
And Figwit is also in a very good New Zealand music group called the Black Seeds.
And coincidentally, his girlfriend works at Weta Digital.
And his father was also an elf.
Yeah.
Anyway, there you go. So you got to talk about Figwit.
We were fortunate on these shows to have
dialogue mixer with the experience that we did have, and Michael Semanek was able to clean up quite a bit of fairly marginal production audio. And that scene with Arwen and Elrond was an example of that, where because of script changes and so on, suddenly we were obliged to use a production line that was very awful and match it into ADR, which had been recorded either side of it.
We had a different close-up of the Shards of Narsil, but it wasn't as dramatic as the poetry, so they did a very, very quick pickup on the sound stages at Stone Street just to get a more dramatic-looking set of shards.
Arwen's role in making the sword definitely grew into a more significant role as Film 3 was evolving.
Makes him more involved in her and Aragorn's combined fate rather than this character who's just waiting around for other people to make decisions, you know.
When Arwen drops the book, it's one of these chances for sound to really start to tell the story. It's all about the impending doom. That Arwen has actually given away the grace of the Eldar that she had and is becoming mortal as a consequence. And so her fate is pretty much tied to the rise and fall of Sauron.
One of the interesting things about these sort of ethereal scenes is getting the right balance between the magical, more surreal effects and the realistic, environmental, straightforward effects, and getting that sort of balance happening right, and with the music as well.
This was nearly a teaser trailer for the Return of the King theatrical cut, sort of, you know, tease the audience of what was coming, and this idea of the reforging of Narsil. You know, there's such great imagery. Of course, there was tons and tons of coverage from a million angles of this, and these are real smiths.
It's actually impossible to reforge a sword this way, and you actually have to make a whole new blade for it.
Oh, for humans, maybe.
But not for elves. The sparkle on the sword flame was something our effects guys came up when we were shooting forging that went on in the caverns below Isengard, and one of the effects guys just put this little extra, I think it was phosphorus or something, on the blade itself, and whenever you'd hit it, you'd get this cool little sparkle.
The Gondor theme, it's quite stately, and it is played on the brass. I mean, the brass are really central to Gondor. And it has a bit of a feeling of lost grandeur to it.
Minas Tirith was a large miniature that Alex shot, and we used that as our center point of reference.
Now here's something interesting, because all these shots are basically built only up to the first story, and everything else you see is miniature, matched into the camera move. This, of course, is all miniature here, with, you know, the digital Gandalf racing through the streets. We had a lot of fun with this, because Peter basically said, give me some shots of get Gandalf from the bottom to the top and make it interesting, make it exciting, and indicate how far he has to go, how huge the city is. And basically, we were given the carte blanche to figure out what to do. So we did again did a series of handheld shots. My motion control operator, Hank Prinz, worked out some shots, and we'd show them to Peter, and he'd choose the ones he liked, and we'd refine them. Then Hank would program them as motion control shots, and we'd shoot them. For the high angle shots of Minas Tirith, we had to tip it up 30 degrees because we could never get the camera high enough. So when you can't get the camera low enough or high enough, it's easy to just tilt the entire set. When we get to the very, very top of Minas Tirith, that was only built up to slightly above the height of the main door. Essentially, all that exists here is the tree and that little bit of door. And everything else that you see in the shot is a miniature extension at 14th scale.
Anytime we're up at the top of Minas Tirith, these are all these shots are all green screen, which I think was sort of impressive in terms of just the bulk of these shots. There's this, there's the whole coronation sequence which takes place up there, and they literally were, it was all green screen shots. You feel you're up on top of this big prow in the center of Minas Tirith.
And the interiors as well. They're putting the top on this throne room.
Yeah, the top bit is all digital extension up above the sort of the round part up above the throne there. It was all digital.
And extending back toward us, too.
Extended, right? On all sides, yeah.
Yeah, it's amazing.
There's an absolutely fabulous matte painting of the ceiling, because, again, it was only built at the top of the column. And everything else you see above that is painted in all that ceiling stuff. This is a brilliant piece of painting.
Lord and steward of Gondor.
This is probably the biggest single interior that we built. And this was also built on Stage O, which was down at the docks, the same place that we built the exterior forest where the horses gallop in the second film. This is a beautiful set. It's one of my favorites.
Basically, we'd run out of big stages that had nice tall ceilings, and there was a bit of a scramble to try to find another warehouse somewhere in Wellington. So the gang found this amazing warehouse right there on the water.
There's a nice little sound effect associated with that, the Boromir flashback that we see there, which I kind of love because it's one of those almost sort of subliminal sound that I think just works on an emotional level. And it's something that we first used in the Boromir lying dead in the canoe that we first see in the extended edition of film two. And it's actually the sound of bees buzzing around a pot of honey, recorded very close. So it's, and then it's slowed down, but it's, what it does is it gives you this sort of very emotional, buzzy quality, almost as if we're inside Denethor's head.
And Boromir was pierced by many.
This is really the first setup scene for Denethor, really. I mean, he had never met this character before. So, it was pretty interesting. His whole process, he's a pretty interesting character. He was very difficult to, ADR from memory too. He wasn't an easy actor to ADR with. He
right outside the door, you've got sort of shunting trains, you've got trucks, you've got downtown Wellington as well. So all of which meant that the production audio was absolutely screwed, which was such a great shame because John Noble, the actor who plays the character of Denethor, is a very much a performance on the day based actor. And so John found it really hard to walk into an ADR studio, let's face it, you know, 2.5 years, 3 years after he'd actually done the part.
He always felt his performance was pretty good on the day.
And it was.
And it was.
It's pretty rich.
Yeah. Well, some of it actually got a bit a bit strong at times. You have to tone it down a bit to go for slightly lesser taste. He got a bit at times. But I found him an interesting character, actually. I've got an interesting
Aragorn. Yeah, I sort of feel quiet through these scenes with him in this big throne room, because I'm always remembering the tension that's actually in the scene. And the very first time when I was assembling the footage, feeling the tension throwing between these two. It has a lot of energy when you're cutting like that.
We ended up with a pretty similar scene actually to the original cut from this, from memory.
These were green screens, so Gandalf would be shot in the plate, and then we would green screen Pippin in there and sort of place him where we needed to. These doors just opened up onto a parking lot. So they built this sort of exterior courtyard, and then on the outskirts was the crew parking lot. And so there were some shots where we go wide, we sort of crane around. You just saw cars parked on the outsides of Minas Tirith. I think we had to make it seem as though they were 300 feet up in the air.
This is all shot in layers because we couldn't get the camera through. So each of those buildings as it goes by had to be shot and then pulled out as the camera passed it so we wouldn't run into it.
This virtuoso shot that starts as a wide and ends up on a two-shot.
Right.
Gandalf and Pippin.
This was our single most difficult miniature shot to do because of the problems of tracking it. So what you're seeing here is the top of the flat surface is real, the sides are digital, and everything behind it is the miniature. The prow of the Court of the Kings is built flat on the parking lot, and they did a very complex train move that was just kind of a grab shot. No tracking data was made for it or anything. That shot took 3 weeks to do.
You really don't know it, but any one of these shots that we're looking at right now is a composite. All these ones where Gandalf and Pippin are talking.
The Wellington weather was great for creating the Cloud of Mordor because we would get these big storms coming in off of the ocean and just try to make sure we were out there shooting them all. One day I got a call from Peter saying there's a great storm cloud coming in over the South Island. It's like, okay, we're on it. Someone went out and shot it. Yeah. The problem you have with a sequence like this is if you have everything under a dark cloud, it's either going to look like a nighttime shot or it's going to look very dark, which doesn't make for a very interesting film. So the idea that we came up with is that we would have this big valley with the cloud of Mordor extending out from the Mordor Mountains, but under either side of the clouds, you would still be able to see the world out there, and there would be this bright sky that would allow light in. So then, depending on how we were shooting, we would be able to rake light in from under the cloud from either the left or the right side. So we could always get some interesting lighting on the scene, but still maintain this heavy presence over the top of everything.
This was shot up here in the hills in Wellington.
I think this was the the end of film too.
Yeah,
I wasn't there that
yeah,
day. So
that's right.
They went over to doing more on-set mocap with Gollum. The on-set motion capture negated the need for any animation supervising coordination. We just take what we, you know, what we'd get. As it turned out, it was certainly a step in a new and exciting direction that I think we'll see more and more of.
Yeah, it was. Amazing just to be able to do that, just to be able to go there and capture it, whether it was, you know, whether even it was just, if it was just a reference, it was pretty incredible to be able to capture his motion as Peter was directing it, you know, rather than going back to a motion capture stage later.
Our wardrobe team did such a wonderful job, not just, you know, the actual creation of these costumes, but also just the way they were worn down for specific parts of the movie, and the actual team themselves at each of the production units making sure that they were keeping track of the correct continuity, that did have the correct wear and tear for that part of the journey. You know, it just helps add to it, something we take for granted that we don't even maybe think about, but it just sort of helps sort of keep playing along, you know, this journey. It really, really kind of sells the scenes.
Now, this is another scene, same, added for the DVD extended cut, but I love this because it's sort of the uncrowned king scene. I mean, that's how I refer to it myself.
The good thing about this scene was that moment of emotion and pathos as the light comes on the crown and then fades off again.
This is one of those scenes that just makes the world so much bigger than the actual story you're following. Which, you know, is obviously the depth that Tolkien had in his books. It's a world that a story is happening in rather than a world that's been written for the story.
And now we rejoin the theatrical cut, still in progress. Although what's great here is we've got added little beats here between Pippin and Gandalf with the smoking and the coughing and the sort of, you know, rapport that's building up between them, which is going to become very significant as the film moves toward its climax.
The scene was a pickup scene, a new scene here. Pippin was originally lying in bed and heard Gandalf coughing and got up and gave him a drink of water. And then
here's some of the footage.
Yeah, the bones of that scene were all there, shot originally, and what was added, I believe, is the detail, sword, seeing Pippin take out the sword and looking at his weapon.
We felt that need to set up the uniform, because later down the track, when there's another scene when he's got the uniform on, he's talking to Faramir.
This scene is a good example of playing up the contrast between the quiet before the storm at Minas Tirith and what's happening at Minas Morgul, where the evil is about to erupt. It's also very nice to be able to have so many quiet scenes early on in the movie, because we knew from the beginning with all the battles later, it was going to have to have some loud scenes. So it's nice to be able to really get simple and quiet.
Mount Doom is this constantly exploding, rumbling presence of evil that you always know is just across those hills.
And we're really sort of able to play that up with the contrast in sound.
Yeah, the great evil and the death of our time is just across the air, and we can see the glow.
It does make it tricky sometimes to try and get enough sort of power out of the sound design elements when we're dodging and weaving around quiet voiceover. It's one of the small mix challenges.
There's Peter Jackson barking orders on the boat. Now, this whole speech here that Ian McKellen does was conceived during post-production. The idea to absolutely clarify Osgiliath, Minas Tirith, their proximity to one another, the strategic imperative that if Osgiliath falls, then Minas Tirith is vulnerable.
this moment between Gandalf and Pippin, we did shoot some of it in the pickups, where we're getting into the drama a bit more, and it's really nice, this concept of cutting together the threats.
Peter felt strongly that Return of the King needed its own sort of really clear personification of evil, because after all, Sauron really is a disembodied eye, and Saruman has now bit the dust. You know, the idea of building up the Witch King, armoring up, getting his helmet put on, his sort of gauntlets attached and so on, to really give you a personification of the evil on sort of the ground level.
Yeah, I mean, we really, really tried to make the Witch King getting his armor on as creepy as possible, because Peter wanted it to be a very otherworldly place. But, of course, in the mix, we just weren't able to sort of realize that, because we were obliged to actually be able to understand the voiceover, funnily enough.
Minas Morgul is his last.
Here's the first view of Minas Morgul. Just a little tiny foreground set. Everything else is miniature. Now, Minas Morgul has the sickly glow, because it's a poisoned city. It's leaking toxins, because the whole thing is that this is trickling down through little cracks in the rocks, and it's seeping down into the swamp that surrounds it. So here, as they're creeping across here in front of Minas Morgul, there's just a tiny little set. It's just basically a walkway and a few rocks. This is a full size. This gargoyle is real, but pretty much everything else is miniature. Now we're going to do a shot where we're going to tilt up the wall to the stairs of Cirith Ungol. And again, that upstairs only go up about 8 feet. Everything beyond that is a multiple scale miniature. There's two scales here, laying down flat on the ground, of course, so we could build it long enough, and then matching the perspective. The biggest problem there was how to make the stairs show, because the problem is that the stairs are supposed to be secret. You're not supposed to be able to see them, but you need to be able to see them. So the combination of putting chalk on the edges and lighting it in strong backlight so the edges just slightly light up, so you just barely see the staircase winding up there without actually being too obvious about it.
Now this scene is where the ring starts to pull Frodo in towards Minas Morgul. There's a lot of low-end rumble sweeps. They're Dopplered, so you get that sense of movement as if they're sweeping in towards Minas Morgul, physically pulling Frodo in. And there's some singing and whispering and black speech, and that's all emanating from the ring. The beauty of this scene, for me, is the brief moment of silence before the eruption. Probably the most important tool in our toolbox is being able to create silence. And in fact, the more intense and energetic the scene gets visually, the more important of a tool silence becomes. And it actually has an inverse relationship in terms of the busier the scene is in terms of all the sound happening, the more power that silence has. And so we're always looking for, you know, the key moment to be able to take all the sound away and just strip it down to silence.
Mm. To get a little bit zen about it, it's the whole sort of yin and yang thing. You can't make a sound powerful and big unless you've got something to actually balance it with.
This moment coming up with the Witch King is one of those moments that we're all sort of dreading. It's one of those moments when we need to physically almost feel the pain that the characters are feeling in the scene, which is coming from this just ridiculously high-pitched scream.
I can feel his blade.
So it's one of those moments we were always sort of dreading, knowing that it was going to have to be almost painful.
And that was the challenge, was to cause Frodo and Sam to actually cower, put their hands over their ears.
Mm.
But to be not a painful experience per se for the audience.
I remember a funny experience we had during an early tent mix on that scene, and it was one of those all-nighter tent mixes that we were going through. And sometime in the middle of the night, it must have been 3 a.m, I was there with Mike Jones, who was doing the tent mix. We were working on that one moment, and because I'd been in there for so many hours, I think I was starting to lose perspective and probably hearing as well. And I just felt like we weren't getting enough power out of that Witch King scream. And so I kept having him turn it up. I had him put it in all the speakers. We pitched it higher. We just did everything we could do to make it stronger. And then I remember in the morning, you came in with fresh ears, and we played that for you, and you just started swearing and said, that is ridiculous.
It was just like, it started, and I couldn't get my hands over my ears fast enough.
Hip, hip, hip.
This is one of the sequences we tried the onset motion capture for.
Now, to create Gollum, we used a series of techniques to move him. One of them was rotoscoping over Andy Serkis's performance, removing Andy and putting Gollum in to match Andy's movements exactly. We also did motion capture. Motion capture would require us to have Andy go back into an empty stage with all these cameras that recorded his movement and repeat his performance on the stage without any other actors. And I had been pushing to come up with a way to do on-set motion capture. And in the sequence when Gollum starts climbing up the mountain, we actually finally did simultaneous on-set capture, which saved days of having to go on a motion capture stage.
It was quite nice to finally be able to get that to work. That's something that I've been thinking about for a long time, being able to put a character like that into the set and motion capture it and have that actually be useful.
I was really glad that we pushed that technology forward.
So essentially Andy was acting in his motion capture suit with the little pinpoints all over it that would, in the multiple cameras that would record his movement, but he got to act with Sean Astin and Elijah while he did it.
Correct. And of course then Fran didn't have to go back on the motion capture stage, and thank God for that, because we didn't have time for them to go back on the motion capture stage at that point in post-production.
It's been very quiet across.
It's nice to get a bit more of Faramir's lieutenant in this extended cut, so that when he ends up getting killed, a little bit more affected by that death.
We've sent scouts to Kaer Andros.
In the DVD extended cut, the Battle of Osgiliath is really in two sections. The original conception was the whole battle for Osgiliath occurred much, much earlier, just generally.
Putting it back here was a good idea, actually. You basically set up the whole Minas Tirith thing and Gandalf and Denethor, and you sort of knew who Denethor was, and it linked you immediately to Faramir. Made it a lot stronger. At this stage, Peter wants to introduce Gothmog. Peter felt that the orc army needed some sort of leader.
There was a realization that it'd be good if we could kind of crystallize the enemy a bit more and to have a character that we can really kind of focus on.
Gothmog was played by Lawrence McQuarrie, who also was featured as Lurtz, and who else, Barry?
Let's see, Lawrence was also the Witch King in
that's
some
right,
of the sequences.
That's right.
In fact, he played opposite himself in some of these shots.
That's right.
And that's our stunt coordinator, Kurt Maxwell, who gets shot with that arrow.
And tumbles down the stairs.
I think we shot this on Peter's birthday.
We did. In fact, I think this was done, we brought out gifts.
Yes, we did.
And we videotaped it and sang songs.
Yeah, I think Andrew Lesney gave Peter not a 3D camera, but a 4D camera.
That's right, and he used it relentlessly since then.
And then he also had his 3D stereoscopic camera that he used to document the production from that point forward.
That's right.
This scene obviously builds up the whole invasion concept. It also shows the orcs as being very cunning tacticians. You know, up until now, even with the Uruk-hai, they've been more strength in numbers, but now they're actually showing wits and the ability to control themselves to a level that they can invade under stealth, which is, you know, is scary.
I think what's also great about these sequences is just showing off some of the new Film 3 orc armor that Workshop worked on in order to create kind of another new variation of orc. It's sort of like deep inner Mordor orcs that you've never seen before, you know, that these are the cream of the crop. These are really the badasses of orcdom.
Yeah, the shock troops.
Yeah.
One of the things that seemed to trickle down and end up in a lot of shots was that the orcs lumbered along and they looked very ape-like.
It was always a struggle. Once they start putting on the rubber outfits and stuff, they go straight into Planet of the Apes.
The orc sounds were a real challenge in that we had to have such a huge variety and they couldn't sound too much just like straight animal.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I think part of the challenge is giving them this sort of nasty, animalistic quality, but also keeping them sort of enough in the human range. So we used a lot of combinations of humans doing animalistic sounds and animals that are sounding sort of human enough.
I had no idea that Peter had planned this tower to be that high off.
There were a lot of things that we had no idea what Peter was planning.
Peter said, here's what I need. Find some angles that reveal the beacon. And then we essentially went off and figured them out. Because none of this stuff was really a previst. It was just drawn, but we were pretty much figuring it out as we went. We would essentially push the sets around until he found something that he wanted, and then with his handheld camera, he'd show us what the blocking was. So a lot of the stuff was directly interactive with him.
It's again all blue screen up there with Pippin, adding the stormy clouds of Mordor
and the establishers with the miniature was
miniature with a CG
double.
Yeah.
Now I have to say that one of the most significant unnamed characters in this movie is coming up here. He just does such a great job reacting.
This moment here. Of Christian. Oh, no, sorry, I was looking at the pillar. I thought that was Christian. Oh. No, but the other shot, that's...
It was, actually.
Yeah, and as I recall, that was directed by Barry Osborne, our producer.
It was directed by Barry Osborne, so, and yeah. I misread one of his cues. It was completely my fault, and nearly burned the set down.
That's right.
Yeah, we actually set that on fire, and Peter wanted me to let it burn down, and they lifted parts of that and used it for some of these beacon lighting on top of the mountain.
Like Middle Earth Internet.
Lighting of the beacons is Gondor signaling to Rohan for aid. So it's using the Gondor theme. It's sending it out across the mountains. The music was used so much at the heart of the story, the center of the story. And by working with Peter and Fran so carefully on it, and with Philippa on the text and using the Tolkien languages, the music was able to be created in a way that was at the center of this piece. And I didn't know that, actually, starting out, that that's what it would be. It wasn't like we had this discussion. And it was just something that evolved through the process of really just of telling the story. And I think Peter and Fran wanted the music to be expressive in that way, to be used in a way that was good storytelling. It's an older style. It touches people. I mean, storytelling is something that's been around for a long time. And everybody loves a good tale. And Peter is a great storyteller. And by allowing me to express the story in the music, you connected with people in the way that music can. And I'm seeing that. And it's fascinating to me, actually, to see the reaction to it and the knowledge of the music in the films, that people know all the moments and they know how the music relates to every frame of the movie. I mean, they know everything about it.
The bell there that they're ringing was a little pet sound that I was intent on us getting, because I remember that the sound that I'd heard actually in a Zen monastery, which was one of these big propane gas canisters with the bottom cut out of it that they had hit, you know, with a big stick. And I remember that hearing that sound many years ago and thinking it was the right sound for that big gong. So essentially we went out and got all these different gas bottles and strung them up in our record room and struck them and ended up using a combination of them for that sound. And for me, it's an example of just getting the right sound for what you see. And, you know, God is in the details.
Gosh, we cut this scene, I don't know how many times. The original scene we cut with Pete, and there was a few extra lines in there, and Ian was playing a slightly different way. And then we recut it again with Fran. And then we had, I think Philippa got in on it as well at some stage. I think it was one of those sort of scenes that went backwards and forwards, and we were still playing with this scene like right up to the last. You know, there was one of those sort of scenes that we just kept on playing around with.
I just liked all the horses.
Yes, and he used to have a thing about the horses. It was always more horses, better.
Yep. Horses, fine.
I wish I could muster a legion of dwarves.
These guys in those shots with Legolas there, they were the horsemen. They were just riding around in a circle constantly. We basically just had like
10 horsemen that just rode around him. It looked like they were all heading out. There was a little hobbit horse we had to stick in there. Anytime you saw more than, in these shots, more than, I'd say, 100 horses, they were all added. They had a mix and match. They had a button where you could sort of randomize the bulkiness of the person, the type of horse, the color of the horse, and so it was sort of automatically built in. And so you just say, give me, you know, 10,000 horses, and would know to put different helmets and spears and things on. And then give them different walk cycles, and just so they didn't appear all the same. These front little group here are obviously the live-action ones, and all the ones in the background sort of winding up the hill and up into the city. And the city itself is all digitally added. There we tracked Mary onto. There was a jockey, basically, that we got to ride the horse because the horse was a little testy, but so we had to track Mary on.
I love that one little sort of chicken. Well, it's not really a chicken, but it's an orc call that he gives out. But it's I love it because it sort of echoes off the background buildings. It's almost as he's sort of calling out to his mates to come on.
So again, anytime you see past 10 or 20 feet, that's all miniatures back there and digital set extensions and terrains and skies and fell beasts and all the other good stuff.
Well, when the fell beasts started coming in, you know, at this point, we'd just be given the shot and say, we'll put some fell beasts in here. And because Pete had shot all this out, I don't think with any of us present at that point, or at least without the idea of having fell beasts in there particularly. And so, you know, it was just, well, start putting them in where they look good. Kind of big turn, you know, a 360 shot like that first one, you know. There are any number of places where you can put them in where they'll look good. And it's just a matter of, you know, choreographing it so it makes some kind of sense. And when the three are attacking the horsemen, you know, it gets into some very complicated staging. For the long shots, they tend to look better close than they do at a distance because their wings are very, very wide and probably the right width to keep something aloft.
The interesting thing about Gothmog is that the actor on screen is Lawrence McElroy, and the voice itself is actually coming from Craig Parker, who played Haldir, and so it's quite cool, you know. One would never expect that Haldir would have such an evil voice.
The time of the Orc has come.
Originally, during principal photography, we saw Gandalf arriving at this moment. This is when he first gets to Minas Tirith. So, for storytelling reasons, Peter wanted him to be at Minas Tirith, have his meeting with Denethor, set that up, have the beacons lit, and then have this retreat from Osgiliath happen after he was there, and Gandalf rides out intentionally to save them.
We sort of thought, well, hold on, it's a bit odd for Gandalf to be riding out of Minas Tirith to rescue them with Pippin on. But no one seemed to be too concerned about it, because it was obviously thinking, oh, well, take Pippin for a ride, for a bit of action. An interesting thing in this scene is the camera suddenly sort of wobbled off the thing. We said, we can use that. We can put Minas Tirith in there.
That shot is a kind of a case in point of all the post-production facilities' ability to deal with effect shots, because that was sort of shot on the back of a truck, just riding over rough ground behind horses, no tracking markers from memory. Just basically we want to keep the horses, and you've got to replace and leave everything else in it and put Minas Tirith back there.
Right. Replace the sky, the distant mountains, pretty much only keeping the ground and Gandalf and the horses running.
Battalions of orcs are crossing the river. It is the Lord Denethor predicted.
So this sequence here used to be before Gandalf met Denethor.
This was the entry scene into Minas Tirith, not riding up.
Yeah.
This was where he entered.
So it was far better moving it around because you had actually met Denethor first, so you knew he was, you know.
The problem was,
yeah.
Yeah, this restructuring is very effective.
Once the film is actually running, as you're working with it and stuff, the scenes actually tell you what they need. once the things are starting to fit together, and especially once Peter's in the room and his thrust of storytelling is going, the shots actually take themselves out.
They do. Yeah, exactly, they do.
Tell me everything. Tell me all you know.
This was a scene that we dropped out of the theatrical version. It was sort of a bit similar to the previous time you'd seen Denethor.
We had three scenes almost following each other of Denethor in the throne room.
Oh, you learn something about Faramir. I mean, you definitely learn, but it wasn't essential necessarily to a theatrical room. It was just one of those scenes that you had to drop out of the three. You had to drop one, and the stronger ones obviously were the one with Gandalf, the one you had to have.
Yeah,
and you had to have the one with Pippin and the
where Faramir gets sent out.
Yes.
Yeah.
But this is good. This is good background stuff for the DVD viewers.
Yeah, I mean, one of the reasons that a lot of these scenes ended up in the extended cut is simply that for pace and momentum issues, you can watch the film without knowing all this sort of deep background and get it. Denethor's grief, his collusion, his sort of tactical incompetence. But here you can kind of sketch in, what the real motivating kind of nuance is. And that's what's happening here. But yeah, in the theatrical cut, by going back to Denethor and sort of shading in things that you've sort of already kind of made clear, at least on a sort of surface level, you slow the momentum way down. And that for a theatrical cut, that was clearly the priority.
You would not have known your son.
Did they ever fix the throne rocking?
No, that was something that no one ever picked up except Rick.
Look at the shot. Look at the chair. Boom, boom. This huge stone-like throne actually moves when Denethor hits it.
Yeah, Rick was very concerned about the throne rock. He thought it would be such a solid throne it wouldn't rock when he hits it. But I actually think it... who's to know what it's made of? Is it made of marble or is it made of wood? It's a bit hard to tell.
I mean, he'd get piles if it was made of marble, wouldn't he?
Mm.
They wouldn't have done that to the kings of Gondor.
I know, not Denethor.
I mean, Denethor's got enough troubles without piles as well.
See, you watch these extended cuts and you see this stuff that you didn't think you were going to see.
It's a great scene. It just completely shows Denethor's weakness utterly for the ring that, he'd even consider using it when it isn't even in his grasp. He's sort of fooling himself and then, he hasn't even got the strength to do that.
One of the nice things about Peter, he was always open to hearing where your emotion was engaged. As scenes got tightened down, stuff like where Frodo's slips might come out. And then I found myself sort of thinking, that slip is the bit where I really get worried about the height they're at. That's what does it for me, is the slip. And Peter would go, all right, yeah, put the slip back in.
Here's a miniature foreground. This was a shot that was plugged in at the very last minute. Miniature foreground for Gollum to sit on. Because they needed to have a transition to this shot where he's on that flat and they hadn't shot it. So,
what we would have is just really an idea in our heads of how Gollum's dirt progressed during the scene. I think it was mostly just something that we talked about and everyone knew what to do with him in the various scenes to get him that way.
I feel so bad for our actors here because when I was shooting this stuff, I must have done about 10, 12 takes of Elijah and Sean climbing up this thing in varying angles, and I had a crane and just a whole bunch of stuff, and it was quite a workout, even though the physical stairs themselves weren't that long, still having to go up and down.
I think these were the first Gollum shots shot. First Gollum. Mm-hmm. This was the first Gollum stuff shot back in a little gymnasium as weather covered.
These scenes were shot in the squash court of a hotel in Queenstown.
Yeah, I remember being, there's weather cover they need in Queenstown because it's starting to snow and go crazy, and it was everyone went out to this little lodge with an indoor handball court and this tiny little piece of wall. It's like, right, we'll shoot what we can here. And it was also used for some of the Black Gates, Frodo and Sam Black Gates stuff hiding behind the rock.
This is Lawrence playing against Lawrence, actually.
Exactly. Lawrence as Gothmog and Lawrence as the Witch King.
We close enough on that on that fell beast for you?
Yeah.
No, for that close-up of the fell beast, you really wanted to get the sense that this was sort of a big, agitated beast. So, yeah, that little bit of movement in the head and the breathing just really give you the sense that it's alive.
Pete and Fran wanted the Witch King to be very lean.
And Lawrence, though very tall, has also got a real sort of linebacker's physique.
And obviously, an actor with that amount of cloak and armor and a helmet just still doesn't look like that. So
they kind of digitally squished him.
Towards the end of the production, like in the last month, a lot of the Witch King shots got just squashed in compositing just to give them a leaner look.
So he became just a hair taller and a hair thinner.
Didn't happen to all the shots, so there's some that you may notice that don't have that look. It's a very subtle thing.
I didn't think they would find any livery that would fit me.
Once belonged to a young boy of the city. A very foolish one.
This is added for the extended cut, this sequence here.
Instead of attending to his...
I quite always like the scene.
This was yours.
Yes.
Of the, Pippendangas thing.
It's always said, isn't it, that when you're fighting for time... That it's the soft scenes, the character scenes that tend to go.
Yes. Yeah. We tend to get lost, don't they?
Yeah.
It's a shame. A shame, actually, that happens. Mm. It's one of those tricky scenes because they had already got rid of the set, so we had to figure out how we're going to get backgrounds for it, and they didn't build the set again, did they? They had to find bits and pieces.
Build the set again.
So pretty much any set that we were in, we would, in addition to doing whatever actual camera-specific moves that we had, we would also shoot them as tiles, as a backup element, so that when if digital needed to add a background, they could simply go into the tile set, stitch the necessary pieces together, and then build a new background out of it.
When we talk about a tile set, we're talking about a series of images that cover a large scene. So the way you shoot that with a large miniature or a large scenic environment is you shoot a number of photographs that overlap. And then you tile them all together to produce one super large image that you can then work with. So we call it a tile set.
It's possible then to digitally stitch them together into a three-dimensional psych so that you can do camera moves that'll match the foreground move without having to actually shoot a motion control move on the background.
Something that Peter really likes to do with his picture editing is a lot of sort of cross-cutting, and it's something that works out beautifully. In the scene coming up where Faramir is charging into the orcs, counterposed against Denethor, this despicable, careless father figure.
I do not think we should so lightly abandon the outer defenses.
Faramir is a character that I did want to give a certain sound to. It's another fairly tragic character. The panpipe's one of the oldest instruments in the world. And I think I was just waiting for the right moment and the right spot to use it. It wouldn't have seemed appropriate to me to have used it in Fellowship of the Ring. It might have seemed almost too obvious a thing. And I didn't use it in Two Towers. And finally now in the first act of Return of the King, you hear a little bit of this sound, and it only connects to Faramir.
I wish that.
And it's a scene where he's in conference with his father in Minas Tirith, and his father is sending him on a mission that he knows he won't return to. It's a really great moment in the film. And it's a turning point in Faramir, because he knows he's going on this suicide mission. And then as he leads his troops out of the city, you also hear that pan pipes again. But now it's more fully developed, and you hear the piece with a choir and orchestra.
This was a scene with Gollum where the animation was initially too good. You know, the animator animated it like he was really asleep. But unlike the earlier scene where you see him talking in his sleep, you want him to be basically faking it, you know? And so we had to actually go in and say, no, just make him a lot stiffer, make him uncomfortable, make him a bad actor pretending to be asleep, you know?
It's great, great sequence.
So I think this shot was one of the longest in production shots not that it was in production for 3 years, but it was one of the shots we used originally for our first Golem test. But it was also before Andy came out to New Zealand. And I think Randall William Cook was standing in on the day.
What we try to do is to make sure that what we were producing looked like a camera original. You want to make the light that's hitting your characters or creatures or scenes match any lighting that would have been done on the live action. So we would always match that lighting first.
We had some really, really great production illustrations of all these different views, which was very helpful, just in terms of how the final lighting was going to look and what the final color was going to be. This is going to be Gollum indicting Sam. This is an interesting shot. One shot. One cut on the other side of the line here. We're looking down the valley the other direction. It's the only one where we're actually looking the opposite direction down the canyon. Back towards Mordor instead of out towards Minas Tirith. Two shots, actually.
What were you doing?
Gollum is wonderful for a number of reasons. A great deal of artistic skill was put into his animation. A number of technical breakthroughs were made, you know.
You can get amazing details that you could never get with rubber if you were doing a foam rubber Gollum, or with stop motion if you were doing a stop motion Gollum, just because you can really go down to almost subatomic level, you know, and go in and finesse everything and get it looking just right, and then control it. I mean, because mechanicals for Gollum's eyes, for instance, would be virtually impossible to do with the same amount of persuasiveness. Forget the lip sync, but the control you get, you know, with the CG is amazing as far as your detail. No matter how close in you go to a 2D animated hero, his face or her face is only delineated by a certain number of lines, you know? It's harder to do a close-up because you've just got the line for the opposite side of the nose and the two nostrils and however the mouth and the eyes are drawn, right? And so you don't have the luxury of big pantomime, you know, to fall back on. And the drawing's got to be very tight, and yet you're looking at a very small graphic image blown up really big. But here, you know, you just don't do that kind of detail work in 2D.
There's a lot of winds in the movie. There's a lot of wind, and specifically up in these scenes around the ledge, it's obviously the wind is pretty much the only atmospheric sounds we have going, and so used a lot of quad recorded winds so that we could fill the whole room with the sound and have it feel natural.
This is a critical deviation from the book here because, you know, of course, in the book, Sam and Frodo are not separated. And for a number of dramatic reasons, Peter wanted to separate them and have, you know, Gollum drive this wedge that's so effectively driven that Sam is essentially driven away, sent away by Frodo. And so the challenge was to keep this out of the knowledge of this away from fans and others, so it was a constant battle to keep the script pages hidden, not talk about it. All of our licensees, you know, game designers, trading card designers, and so on, couldn't be told about it, and I frankly lived in constant dread that the information would get out. But it didn't.
Yeah, and the challenge, of course, again, it's not that you're trying to deceive people, but you don't, because it is a deviation, there are such fans of the novels, you don't want them to prejudge what the film's going to be like because it deviates from the book. You want them to see the film and actually decide then whether it was a good decision or bad. And I think it's quite obvious that they embraced the idea.
There was a shot done here which changed the animation. Because at one stage, when Gollum would walk past here and turn around and smile at Sam. And his friend said, oh no, we can't have him doing that. We have to reanimate. So we had to redo that shot to get Gollum to just sort of look and just walk away.
Well, Fran is the great guide, you know. Fran is the writer of the relationships and Frodo's relationship to Gollum. Sam's relationship to Gollum. How Frodo relates to Gandalf. I mean, Fran always seemed to me at the center of the emotional heart of the film.
And this beautiful, beautiful sequence with the song. And one of the biggest things that I feel about working on the entire production is gratitude, I guess, to Jamie and to Peter, to be put in a position where I was allowed to handle this sort of footage and this sort of sequence.
All the extras' faces were beautiful, fantastic. Yes. Eh? I mean, the casting was wonderful through here. Yeah. It was one of those days. It was raining and it was sort of off and on. The weather was changing, but it was. And also, you could have cut the scene anyway. I mean, Annie did a good version of this scene, and then we did and then we played around with it again, reduced it down. Then we did a few, we changed it again to get it shorter, flipped a few shots, and got them to look slightly differently. And it ended up with Ben still actually had that lovely feeling to the scene.
This sort of stuff. I mean, it will probably never come again for me. It is so beautiful.
I really like the way the effects and the music are working together in this scene. And I think Chris Boy's effects mixer did a really tasteful job of sort of picking out just the right details to be focused on at any moment and putting them in this sort of dreamy reverb that really sort of sets up the emotion of the scene in a nice way.
A lot of people probably wouldn't actually realize this, but Faramir in the foreground is on a barrel.
On a tracking vehicle. On a barrel, yep.
Shows how good our riders were in terms of riding so close to this
tracking vehicle.
Keep it all in frame. Now, there are a lot of things that you don't necessarily have clearly worked out when you start a movie. And you get these nice little perfect moments when you realize that all the moons lined up and you had something you weren't expecting. And for us, you know, having Billy Boyd playing Pippin and then realizing that he actually has a gorgeous voice and is really very musical, you know, that wasn't part of the casting of Pippin. It just turned out to be a bonus, an unexpected bonus.
One of the great things about working with Peter and Fran is that they work closely in collaboration with the cast. And I think in one of the meetings that they had, that Billy... somehow they decided that they should have this song and they asked Billy to go off and write it, and he did.
This is an interesting sequence coming up here where I remember when he first turned this over, the first shot he talked about was this big wide shot of seeing Faramir's army advancing on towards Osgiliath, and then panning on to the orcs, seeing them raise their bows, and then basically whipping out with the arrows and seeing this whole line of horses just hit the ground.
I remember we storyboarded and we prevised different shots of all the horses falling in one shot, being hit with arrows. It would have been too, not just too graphic, but the scene plays out just so much nicer by not seeing the death and just it all encapsulated with the juice running down Denethor's lips.
Yeah, and there's a nice kind of resonance with the, you know, the echo of what you don't see, but what you hear and what you can only imagine.
It's the whole callous disregard of the steward, you know, Denethor, who just seemed to sun out to die against this beautiful, sweet voice, this very melancholy song. An extremely personal moment, I think. I mean, Pip's kind of part of the family to have him, in fact, singing through this moment, I think brings a certain connection, yeah. Certainly pulled at my heartstrings.
He could have given that scene to and that footage to 10 different editors, and they would all come up with a slightly different version. It was one of those sort of scenes you can put your own interpretation of where you'd want to cut in and cut out, and you know, the whole pacing rhythm. When I saw the daisies, I thought, wow, this is going to be cool. Let's see all the action.
Lots of horses.
Oh, this is what you call it. This was a big, big picture, big extra. Scene.
These shots, this is done here, these turned out pretty cool, especially where we sort of have this establishing shot. We see the Dun Harrow Plateau, and then when we get to the top, there's some amazing shots looking down, back, So this one here is basically he just shot the live action at the bottom, and as we go up, we had to sort of paint that zigzag pattern, and then the plateau, and the whole top part was all a matte painting. And then we come back this way and we look down, they were just standing on the parking lot with a green screen in front of them.
Now that started off with a really good scenic shoot. So mostly what you're seeing is live photographic elements, but then we stitched them and reprojected them onto the mountain terrain to fit them into the shot of the guy standing on the edge of the cliff. We have till
dawn. Part of this is shot on the back lot, but the wide shots were done on the South Island in a very remote location called Greenstone, which was about an hour and a half by car to get to. And we actually organized, it was across this lake from Queenstown, and we organized this flotilla of boats and a little fleet of airplanes so that we could get people in and out of there in about half an hour. But it was a beautiful location. I loved it.
I would have loved to have seen some of these locations. And we heard about them because, particularly on the early part of shooting in South Island, we were talking to Peter on a daily basis because we would send our material down to him to look at. And so we would hear the latest adventures they were having with floods and snowstorms and whatnot. But safe in our nice warm studio.
The cavern in the distance is a visual effect.
What's cool about those shots of Vigo looking, the close-up, and tensing up, you know, and looking past camera, and then also his POV of looking at the horse skittering around is Pete was kind of running up against the end of the day, and they actually shot those, I think, it's at the same time. Had one camera pointing one direction, the other camera pointing back at Vigo, and were actually rolling footage at the same time just because they were running out of time that day.
It's a good little miniature right there.
A night establisher. With the little lights inside the tents and so forth. So it makes the whole point about the fact that it's on the top of a mountain and that it's nice and peaceful and everybody's kind of, except of course for Theoden's tent where high-level conferences are going on.
Sorry. It isn't all that dangerous.
This was done ready to set up the Ewan and Mary thing so that it wasn't such, didn't come out such a surprise when she picked him up on the horse.
Yeah.
Later down the track. Mm.
This is all composite shot, dual pass motion control. Dom on the blue screen, and then Miranda Otto on the set.
But we did use scale doubles for women. And I mean, Tall Paul played Arwen in Fellowship on horseback a couple of times in little close-ups, and also cradling Frodo just before he arrives in Rivendell.
That whole scale thing was so well set up in film one that people just automatically think that they're small.
This is a great scene for Carl Urban, which is here in the extended cut. The character of Éomer, you know, is a very strong, silent type, very stoic and fierce, but this sort of gives you a kind of a window into, you know, his mindset and why he is the way he is.
I'm glad we extended the scene. I always felt the scene was important for Éomer.
War is the province of men, Éowyn.
He's basically saying that she should stay in the kitchen.
But Ewan's more determined, obviously, than that.
Here's another one of those great shots where it's the set basically ended where the guys are standing, and that was all miniature extensions and digital off in the background, a digital horse coming up.
That breaking of the
Evenstar.
The Evenstar was it was originally going to be a visual effect, and then we actually did it as a practical.
So what was Evenstar?
What was it
made out of?
We were going to make it out of ice. We tried a lot of different things, and ultimately they made it out of some kind of cast material, like a candy glass or breakaway glass, and dropped it from the top of the stage, on a stage. Good aim.
I like the way this dream ended up working out sort of a very nicely. This sound design flows well. These tents are a little detail that I was sort of intent on getting just the right sound for, and some of the crew spent a bit of time searching out the right tents and setting them up in windy locations and actually, again, recording them with a quadraphonic setup so that we could have, you know, the sound filling the room, but to feel that it was one recording.
And here we have Elrond, one of the last elves in the Middle Earth.
Mm.
And the reason being, he's such a downer these days, they wouldn't have him in the f***ing boat. They said, no, you're not coming to the Undying Land of us, you f***ing moaning bastard. Just bring us all down. I mean, look at him. He's so f***ing depressing, isn't he? I mean, all he talks about is doom. We're all going to die. You're going to die, you know. Just give that man a Valium. Some Prozac, for f***ing sake.
This is always one of my favourite scenes. And I think again it's because of the some of it is because of the set, all the lovely hangings on the walls and the canvas drifting in the wind and stuff like that. One of the best flashing sequences I've ever seen, really.
Yeah, one of the key aspects of this sequence and throughout the trilogy as a whole is that, you know, whenever these characters have these sort of geopolitical kind of speeches where they sort of orient you to what's happening, you know, Peter is quite clever with how he'll give you little flashes, either through montage or insert, to give you a visual reference for what he's talking about.
And the insertion of shots like the Corsair ships and stuff like that, you know, in the early stages, you cut the scene.
You cut
it according to the script and that sort of thing. And when Peter walks in, he brings in a whole another set of thinking and knowledge and stuff.
And in a lot of cases, it was really like adding this little shots and lines within the scenes. It wasn't really doing the whole scene. Quite often it was just adding extra footage within the scene. I mean, obviously the huge amount of time we spent on the pickups for film 3 was really, in a sense, for little bits of drama, but it was also huge amounts of element shooting for effect shots, because obviously in the original shoot there was very little shots, effect shots done for the big battle action, etc. So huge amounts that had to be done for that.
There was a room at Weta which me, Scott Reynolds, Andrew Calder and Peter Jackson would sit in, would just storyboard out the Lord of the Rings. And Rick was charged with keeping us on track and turning up every now and then, making sure we weren't goofing off.
Which, by the way, they were goofing off quite often.
So we'd have heads down, we'd be drawing away, and then, you know, the one moment that we actually put our pens down and we all turned, started talking about stuff, Rick would walk in. So we made this little box camera that we glued up in the corner of the room. It was called the Porus Cam 2000. And it had a little notice that sort of said any information gathered from this camera cannot be used to review storyboarders' pay.
The little moment we just passed there where the wind gust comes, we have the flash insert of the King of the Dead and the tent, the gust comes through the tent, is a sort of interesting example of how Peter sometimes shapes the track in really interesting ways, because originally we had just sort of a standard, you know, wind gust just howling through and blowing the tent open, and when we got to that point in the mix, Peter said, you know, I think it'd be really interesting here if we did something, if it was like the King of the Dead was actually breathing into the tent. And so we ended up doing that. I think that was a really sort of interesting way to go, and it works nicely. I like the idea of to actually have wind become breath.
It is but a shadow on a thought that you love.
This was shot actually on a stage, on the small little stage. We were going to do it outside and the weather forecast was bad, so we ended up doing it. It became a cover set for us. This scene originally occurred inside a tent. The content is very similar to what was originally photographed, but it tended, the original vision was a little too melodramatic, I felt, and this is so much better scene. So we redid it to get the tone right.
I always felt that Ewan was far too tearful.
Yeah, too weak.
Yeah, and that's exactly right. And I want to make it a bit stronger character. Also, he felt it was a bit harsh, him just turning and walking off.
That's right.
He felt he wanted that scene to have a bit of he wanted to be a bit softer, Aragorn to be a bit softer towards Ewan, rather than just turning and walking off. Have you learned nothing of the stubborn? And so we didn't really want to have two tense scenes in a row. We'd just been in that tense scene with with Aragorn and Elrond, and we felt we didn't want to cut straight to another tent scene, so that was the reasoning for doing it in a different location.
The more you look at the film sort of in this kind of light, you suddenly realise how much of it was shot on small back lots, tiny little locations, and warehouses, and just these small sets, and then all the surrounding stuff is manufactured and post, or with miniatures and digital environments. It's more so than the Two Towers, which had a lot of in-camera, wide, scenic stuff. There's a bit of this, but outside Minas Tirith, it's all fabricated based on existing locations like Twizel, but everything seems to be touched, and I think that's why it has such a high effect shot count, not due to creatures and the fantastic stuff, but just creating the world. I love the story of Gamling, because wasn't he originally picked as just an extra?
He was a character, he wasn't like a featured extra, but because he had such a good look and he did such a great job, it just kind of grew, because as we all know, that this picture definitely evolved.
Yeah, no, sure, it's a great story, because it was turned into one line to becoming a hero character, essentially.
This scene was basically the last for principal photography for Theoden and Eowyn, and it was effectively the last thing that we shot, period. Peter had gone to the different sets and ended up at this set at the very end of the day, and it was done on one of these stages that we called the Apple and Pear stage, because it used to be a warehouse for apples and pears, but the reverses obviously are blue screen with a nice little effect done by Weta Digital.
A sequence like this, even though it's all drama, is another sort of example of why this film has such a high effects count, because you establish where they are in the shot before, which is a composite with the two actors and a small amount of set, and then this CG psych that has the sky, and then all the subsequent drama, there's this slightly out of focus background that you take for granted is actually there, but it isn't. It's all replaced.
More despair.
Pass of the Dead uses a Sindarin text. It was created by Philippa Boyens, translated by David Sallow. The Tolkien book contains a lot of lyrics and texts and poems. And one of the ways I wanted to put some of that back into the film was to use the human voice, the choirs. And I wanted the music, again, to sound very old. And so we'll use text for certain scenes in the film, and we'll have the choir singing. And the Pass of the Dead is an all-male group. It's mostly basses. And they're singing in Sindarin, of its poem of Philippa Boyens.
This location is a pretty remarkable spot.
Now, where is this that we shot this?
This is out towards Palliser Bay. It's on the coast, and it's this really strange formation.
It's an area called the Pinnacles, and everything you see there is real. It's just really amazing rock formations.
Very good evocation of mood here. It's going back and forth between the Pinnacles and the live set that they built.
Peter had shot, I think, a scene from Brain Dead there. Mm-hmm. And he always had this in mind for this sequence. I remember very distinctly when we scouted it.
Yeah, it's very bizarre looking.
It's an interesting scene because it's quiet, which enables us to do some really subtle things.
One of those shots you edit, one of those...
mm-hmm. The way is shut.
Whoa!
Oh, wow, that one nailed the coffin on that one, I tell you.
That's a big exhale from the King of the Dead, who's getting ready to get fired up. And he's carrying a little dust with his exhale. The Paths of the Dead is a place where we're really able to do a lot with different vocal elements, whispers and groans and moans, and they'll really sort of lead into the Army of the Dead. The idea of sort of being that they're almost leaking out of the caves, these whispers and voices on the wind.
This stuff was fun. you know, racing out of camps and stuff. That was fun.
Getting them on the road.
Yep.
What had horses in it? and he likes anything to do with horses.
Yeah. Part of the training for all the cast was horseback riding, and Viggo and Bernard became quite avid horseback riders and really enjoy it, and used to go up on the weekends even way beyond the time we finished training. And Viggo actually bought his horse after the movie and another horse.
This was a longer sequence than in the original shooting, it was, but it just went on and on a bit. It wasn't really necessary. It was better to be a lot tighter. And it was interesting to notice the weather conditions changing a lot there.
Yes.
The shot of Mary getting picked up by Eowyn, you know, that was just out the back of Stone Street and a tiny little piece of back lot that you know, that they'd made look like the Rohan camp and the pickups, and just around the corner was Pelennor Fields, the
with
dead
the big mama kill, yeah.
You know, it was just all these tiny little slivers.
And in front of that was the stables of Edoras.
Right.
And next to that was the courtyard for Minas Tirith. You could, like, walk from one end of Stone Street to the other, and you would have traveled thousands of miles of Middle Earth, you know. Very cool.
I love that transition there where we just cut into this big marching orc shot and we've got the drums kicking us in. And for the first time, we're really able to, we've been using drums in all three films, and this is the first time we actually get to see them. And it was just so satisfying to finally get that shot.
Very early on, you know, when they were actually determining what they were going to have these big trolls carrying, are they going to be drums? And they're going, oh, what's the beat? What's the beat that they're actually doing that everybody's marching to? So we actually called up Howard. He came up with a couple options. One was sort of a quicker version of the other. And that was then delivered to Weta after Peter approved it. And they had that then as a reference to go by that the sound team then, of course, used in the track. But that was, you know, something that the animators were working to.
I wrote watching the picture, you know, with Peter's commentary. And he would point out, you know, the whole shape of the scene. He would also describe a lot of what was going on in the scene that I wasn't able to see sometimes, you know, with CG or blue screen. So he would tell me in detail what I would be seeing with computer graphics, you know, of wisps of smoke. But Peter would describe precisely how the smoke would move in the scene and how it would trail off and precisely where it would be gone. And, you know, the smoke was obviously the ghosts, you know, the souls. So just things like that he would describe in, you know, great detail in the spotting, which were invaluable because you would write to them precisely.
I love how Aragorn says, do not look down. Of course, Gimli can't help himself. He's got to look.
Coming up is the whole sequence of the City of the Dead, which is very challenging because we had a lot of illustrations of this, some of which have been done in the very, very beginning of the whole movie. But there were still a lot of unknowns, like how does the actual city appear, for example, because it's a kind of transparent city overlaid over the rocks and so forth. And so again, it's one of these cases where everything had been planned, but we were still inventing it on the set floor as we were shooting it. And again, it's a set which is lighted but not lighted. So we treat it as if it was at the bottom of a well, with the light source being far, far away, coming down to a very narrow aperture. So you have to imply this. The light comes in the same place as the music, as the saying goes.
I remember Peter didn't really want to cut the sequence until he had the visual effects, which, you know, is a little bit backwards from what you normally would try to do. So it meant that we had to go really carefully and go on faith that he would do it in economical fashion and make it work. And he did.
We got David Harburger and Chuck Schulman from the States to come out and help on shooting while Alex was shooting 10 other miniature sets.
So see, this had to be shot with the buildings, of course, absent, and then shot again with the buildings present, using the same trick as we did with Minas Morgul with the glow paint. So you have, in addition to the normal sort of toppy lighting, you also have an internal glow to the buildings, which is done with the transparent black light paint.
For The King of the Dead, we tried to come up with some idea of how we could use a performer, because obviously he's a main character, so getting the performance is essential, but still convey the idea that, you know, he's going to be leading this ghost army. So what we would do is key off of his emotion to reveal certain amounts of the sort of decayed skeleton of the king. So if he was delivering something particularly emotional or menacing, we would bring it, you know, the decayed flesh and the skull, and to really try to get a sense of sort of the, you know, the power of the dead. Other times, if it was a more subtle moment, we would keep the focus on what the performer was doing, so you could really see what his face was doing. And that's really how we keyed the whole army of the dead. We tried to really figure out what was going to make the king work first, and then design everything else to complement that action. So you see the king, and then you start to see the army around him, and they have similar features and similar ideas, but they're not really acting so much. Their state is a little bit more static. And then when they start to attack later on in Pelennor Fields, they sort of develop this rolling, thundering wave where there's almost this bloodlust for battle, and they just become these screaming skeletons that are overtaking the orcs and trailing this ghostly vapor behind them on the battlefield.
All this stuff is shot by David Harburger. All the interior necropolis and City of the Dead. And then Dean Wright, who's the visual effects producer, shot a lot of the multiple layers of these ghosts.
Throughout the course of the movie, we found it necessary to draw upon a lot of different people to do aspects of or direct or supervise shooting. I did some, Rick Porst did some, Fran did a lot with Gollum. Jim Riegel did some horse riding elements for the battles, and Dean Wright supervised most of the shots of the King of the Dead and Army of the Dead in the Paths of the Dead sequence. The skulls came up very late, and I remember it was a race for Weta Workshop to actually produce the skulls that we needed for the sequence. And in fact, after they rushed into it, we decided it was not going to be in the theatrical version, so he had more time to make more skulls for what you're seeing right here.
I should have grabbed one of these skulls.
I'm sure there's a few lying around.
I'm sure there are a few hundred lying around.
I think we started out saying we were going to need we're going to need at least 2,000 skulls falling. I think they ended up with 50,000 of them, because 2,000 was nothing. So they made 50,000 sort of 1-inch square skulls, miniature skulls, that they then had big dump tanks. So each one of those is a anatomically correct skull. And then the actors were shot against a green screen and had to be tracked in and blended with digital skulls. We always knew we were going to do digital skulls that had to match the miniature skulls, that which had to match the live
full-size
action skulls.
Practical skulls.
So
yeah.
It's a huge combination again of all these different scale skulls that all are in the same shot.
It was funny because they were on these kind of latticed steps, you know, and they got all these skulls falling all around them. They're trying to keep moving, but the skulls, even though they're made of rubber, are really heavy when there's like that many of them.
In fact, it's interesting because we're doing these shots now. We're sort of critiquing them, saying, "Oh, these skulls, they're not looking right." Oh, those were the live action ones that were shot on day, you know. Oh, these ones are perfect. Those are the, you know.
And then here's one of the places we got to use our big stadium chants that we did, our black speech. Chants of Katmuda, and which I believe means to war. When we went back this last year for Return of the King, we just really focused on big chanting and death yells, and those really sort of fill out the crowd, give it a really awesome spatial dimensionality.
That's it, because it actually was recorded with a large crowd. I mean, I think we probably had in the region of about, what, 6,000 or 8,000 people, mm-hmm. people who actually stayed around in the stadium to record. And it's just very hard to recreate that kind of scale.
It's not just the number of voices themselves, but it's also the actual space.
You get the cricket crowd with the drunken, unruly mob, and the rugby crowd with the very sort of quieter, cooperative crowd. Not really what you'd expect, but anyway, that's...
It was surprising to me. Yeah. I was thinking, oh, cricket, nice refined game. They'll be very polite. Not at all.
Match after all. And of course, at a one-day match, the main sport that they do is drink.
I said it sort of half-jokingly that we should get a pig head to throw around. And of course, Craig Tomlinson jumped all over that, one of our effects editors who loves that sort of thing.
A lot of the previs we did here was already utilizing Weather Digital's production assets. So we were able to use the Siege Tower models, we're able to use the catapults that they'd built, the digital catapults. But we designed the whole siege, essentially. I mean, one of the weird things for me, and it has not been derogatory, but when I saw the film, I actually felt the battle was, it felt small, because I've been so used to seeing this whole battle laid out in 3D and being able to move around it, look around and actually see the vastness of it, and suddenly having it confined to these shots, it felt smaller. It isn't smaller, but all the stages of it, the siege towers being rolled in, the catapults setting up, we actually planned them in previs to happen in a different order. Obviously when Pete started editing it, the battle was truncated somewhat. So that there's a lot more of a spontaneity and an urgency, and everything's happening sort of, you know, in a shorter time frame. It's all sort of tightened up, so everything's an imminent threat, and it's all arriving at exactly the same time.
Christian really made sense of the choreography of the whole battlefield maneuverings in a very extensive previs that he did.
Talk about how I inspired you, Christian.
I feel a bit of inspiration coming up now.
Prepare for battle!
The way Peter approached making this film, which relied heavily on visual effects, was that to treat it as though they weren't visual effects, is that he was free to put the camera wherever he wanted and have as many wide shots or as many dramatic shots as you would have in a regular movie. So you end up with a film like this with so many hero shots because, in fact, they were treated as they were just a real world. And that really pushed the Weta Group to produce these wonderful shots.
We recorded sports teams on effect of practice night and used them to do the, you know, things like effect running screams, run by sort of microphone screaming and that kind of stuff. And panic reactions for the general army, you know, battle scenes and bits and pieces going on.
This is the section where we went up to the crane yard in Poirua and were able to drop these 2-ton and 4-ton blocks of concrete from 60 feet up in the air on a crane, and we had microphones buried and we had microphones all around.
You know, just being there and actually being around when this big block of concrete was dropped from its highest point.
Dave Farmer basically did all the work on the fell beasts, and yeah, I mean, they're basically just big air whooshes, but there's a lot of low end in them, which is what gives them power and weight and size.
That was one of the first shots I think Peter gave us for Return of the Kingdom, one of the last ones to finish. Actually, this was a shot that we were given as a done deal with just the miniature, right?
Yeah.
So the movie was all done. We had to drop the creatures into that.
And that was our digital Witch King flying up to camera.
It's another close shot on a digital lead character who fortunately had a helmet.
We had a lot of fun with these catapults because they had, I think, only 2 practical ones, but we had to extend them, so you had the feeling there was an entire artillery barrage of them. And of course, when the Gondorians start shooting back, naturally a few catapults have to get smashed by flying rocks. So we had a lot of fun heaving concrete rocks at miniature catapults to smash them flat. It's kind of detail that Peter would just never give up. He would always want to have something like that, even if it's only there for a few frames. It's the kind of thing that makes you feel that, wow, they must have really built 2 dozen catapults. That's amazing.
We brought all sorts of things, car doors and hoods and things like that that we could pile up and drop the concrete blocks on them to get the sound of metal being crushed, because of course Peter was very intent on actually hearing the orcs getting being crushed. It was a great day of recording. Unfortunately, Andy's circus's rap party was the night before. Everyone was a little bit hungover from that.
Everybody was actually incredibly hungover from that.
One of the things about the orc army from the original footage, which disturbed Peter, was that they looked like some sort of, mindless sort of rabble that you wouldn't be scared of anyway. And so when he was doing his pickup shooting, he was being very careful to make them a more regimented, much more threatening sort of group. And also, again, he was trying to personalise that side of it. So you had Gothmog brought in again, his two lieutenants, so that you had people that you could recognise and follow through the fight.
Yes, that's right. It was just hated that.
Yes.
And so he wanted to make them far more like a more formidable army by having more regimented. Exactly right. Mm. It worked so much better. It made them more sort of fearsome.
Yeah.
It's great to see Gandalf fight. It's just like seeing him in Balin's tomb in Moria. It's just really cool when he kind of goes off. It's a nice little sequence that Pete put together.
Despite these epic battle scenes, which do go on for, an extended duration through the cut, you're always, sort of going from macro to micro into these individual moments where the stakes are really one-on-one with your main characters. Like, essentially here, Pippin has saved Gandalf's life, which is a moment that, you might not be able to even think to stop for when you're orchestrating hundreds of thousands of orcs, though most of them are digital. And that's one of the beauties of the movie, on all scores.
We'd already had our plates full with the amount of digital creatures, and the effects load was already looking almost insurmountable. And Alan Lee had done this beautiful sketch of Grond being hauled by these huge beasts of burden. And Pete loved the design, and it also gave Grond a lot more weight. Rather than just being pushed by trolls, it now had these four great creatures that had to pull it as well. It just gave Grond a bigger screen impact as far as being huge and heavy and powerful. And Alan sort of comes in very quietly into a meeting full of people already sort of on the verge of production burnout, and just sort of everyone probably wasn't expecting the last thing they needed was another creature, but Alan sort of brings in this lovely little sketch and goes, I've been talking to Peter and there's been a development.